This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow. Comics have long been an escape into another world, whether on the page or on screen. It's a world where superheroes, villains, magic, and mad science all rule. But Savine Mathadu will tell you that there is much more you can learn from comic books about the material world. Savine Mathadu is a professor in the Department of Material Science and Engineering at North Carolina State University. He's also a program manager of synthesis and processing at the U.S. Army Research Office. And he joins us now on the program to talk about how material science plays out in our comic book world. Tell us, first of all, Savine, welcome to the show. Good to have you here.
Hi, Frank. Nice to be here.
What is material science?
So material science is the study of the relationship between the processing, the structure, and the properties, and then finally the performance of any material system. So it's very different than other engineering disciplines in that it focuses on optimizing or studying the behavior of the materials that make up the world around us.
So this would differ from that old study of metallurgy.
No, it very much falls into metallurgy. Metallurgy and ceramics were the initial roots of material science, which have now spread into bio and nano realms as well.
So you got to know how the material behaves, but not only kind of what it can do for you at the other end. Titanium is strong in light. But if you're going to turn it into something, what's the process by which you can make that and not change the properties that you want on the other end? I guess that's one of the important things you're trying to consider, right?
That's correct. Or be able to control your properties at the other end.
So now we're talking about this with respect to comic books, and I guess we should start with your interest in comic books. You've loved comics for a long time, right?
Yeah, since I was a kid. I've loved comic books and science fiction, and I would read them, and oftentimes they would incorporate some scientific aspects. Now, at the time, those were far less interesting than the action going on in the books. But given that my interest grew over time, with movies coming out and other things as well, I started digging deeper into the old issues and found that comic books have a rich history of not just science, but particularly material science.
Material science and two categories of objects in particular, protective objects and weaponry. So tell us about those.
Yeah, so materials have been important for everything, with major ages being named after materials, Bronze Age, Stone Age, Iron Age. But those were used to make either weapons or defense. And these are also pervasive in the comic books. They're fancy swords or fancy shields, no matter how you portray it. And the materials that are used to make these are what carry the characters through their storylines or enhance their powers.
It's interesting, too, that in the comic books in particular, and I guess to a degree than in the movies it carried forward, there's some time and attention paid to describing how these things work. So it's not just a shield that will protect you. You figure out how. Captain America, for instance, we're going to spend some time with the backstory and explain to you not only what it does, but why it does that, right?
That's correct.
And tell us more about that.
So Captain America's shield is one of the more interesting examples. It was actually in the comic books created by an Army scientist named Myron McLean, who was tasked by FDR to make steel that could be used to make tanks that would fight the Panzer Division. And in his sleep, this iron vibranium being a fictional element, and mystery element fell together into this tank hat shape that ended up being Captain America's shield. Now, the properties of the vibranium alloy were such that it could absorb all energy and vibrations and either store it or redirect it, which made Captain America's shield something that could pretty much stop any blast or that could be thrown around.
So let's listen to Captain America's discovery of his shield in the 2011 film Captain America: The First Avenger.
I took the liberty of coming up with some options. This one's fun. She's been fitted with electrical relays that allow you to...
What about this one?
No, that's just a prototype.
What's it made of?
Vibranium. It's stronger than steel and a third the weight. It's completely vibration absorbent.
How come it's not a standard issue?
That's the rarest metal on Earth. What you're holding there, that's all we've got.
You quite finished, Mr. Stark? I'm sure the captain has some unfinished business.
What do you think?
And There we go.
Yes, you, I think it works.
I think it works. So tell us about that, because actually there's a flaw inherent in what we just heard, right?
Yeah, you hear the shield resonating from the bullets. You hear the pinging on the shield. If it were to absorb all vibrations, it would absorb the energy such that there would not be any pinging sounds.
So there we go. The vibration itself is a giveaway. But I guess the other flaw is that we don't know what the material is made of, because you said there's a mystery element that went into the making of the original shield. So when they're asked to reproduce it, I don't know what it is. But you have some questions about that as well, right?
Yeah. So there's a number of things that come up. Like, given the capabilities that we have today, there shouldn't be a reason where we shouldn't be able to recreate something or look at it at the microscopic or atomic level to be able to find out how we can make something or do it more quickly. From a broader perspective, there's so much time travel that goes on in the comic book worlds that it's surprising that nobody went back in time to go figure out what Myron McLean did in the lab and see what these mystery elements were.
How do you think that the authors of the comics come up with this stuff in terms of the way their minds work, and has that changed much? Are they far-seeing individuals or just kind of making stuff up and getting lucky?
I think that the comic book authors now, and perhaps from the 80s on, tend to latch on to concepts and ideas that were in the public realm or public eye. For example, newer comics have been showing depictions of graphene and carbon nanotubes in the comics. However, if you go back further to the Silver Age, which was in the 1960s and 70s, there was more far-seeing science that was being portrayed in the comic books and also in other science fiction, such as Star Trek and other films and by many fiction authors. So there certainly is far depicting science. I mean, when you talk about things like Iron Man's suit that can fly around and have high energy density to blast and fly and do all these things, we're pretty far away from that. But the depictions seem to be becoming more related to what the public already knows rather than far-seeing in more recent comics.
We talked about the fact that people who create these images and superheroes went to pains to describe how the material works. It suggests that their readers cared about such things. Were you always curious about that, reading the comics? Or do you think that's what led you to your profession now?
Certainly. You know, my father was an engineer, and that was one big factor. But the science fiction and science and the ability to make cool things has always been something that I've wanted to do, and my profession has kind of followed along that line, both in the university and in my responsibilities as a program officer.
The following clip, we're going to listen to X-Men Origins Wolverine. This is a video game clip, and this is going to spotlight Wolverine's transformation.
Your bones will be coated in adamantium. When we're done, you'll be able to withstand anything.
The operation was a success, but he can't be trusted. We have his DNA for Weapon 11. Terminate him.
Maybe you should tell us a little bit more about Wolverine before we hear about some of the technological miracles in there.
Yeah, so Wolverine is a mutant in the X-Men line. He originally appeared in the Hulk and then later on X-Men, who has a mutation where he can regenerate and recover very quickly, and where he has bones that pop out of his knuckles that are shaped like claws. And eventually he gets taken in by a Canadian government project where they want to infiltrate his bones with this super strong metallic material called adamantium that makes him even more impervious and near indestructible.
And it started out with actual bone material coming out of those claws, and now it is this adamantium, which is a real material?
It is not a real material. Adamantium is, depending on which comic book history you subscribe to, a variant of Captain America's shield alloy. That doesn't work as well, but that's nearly as strong. That was also made by Myron McLean.
Named for adamant, no doubt.
Certainly. You know, adamant goes back in history as impervious or strong. Diamond comes from the same root word, but there's some implications to that, just as there's some implications to vibranium and vibration resistance.
How much of your research now could be easily incorporated into the comics? How much of it's reality?
Well, the reality is very strong. For example, in the audio clip that you heard, they talked about it being impervious and lightweight. And the big efforts of my research and the Army's research as a whole are moving towards directions where we can unburden our soldiers and make materials that are lighter and stronger. And in general, that's the feature that pervades the comic books. You want something light, you want something strong as protection.
And I guess, are there other comic book characters that could kind of shed light on the way technology is going that are interesting to you?
Oh, yeah. I mean, there's Spider-Man has always been an interesting character to me with his ultra-high-strength webs, and there's a lot of research being done in things like synthetic spider webs that can be even produced in goat's milk and all kinds of other ways. Magneto has always been a favorite character of mine because when you look at the electromagnetic spectrum, there's a lot that can be done. And Magneto's ability to control magnetism and electricity has some interesting implications for power and energy.
There's this phenomenon that we're calling 3D printing, and that's something that essentially home manufacturing is what we're talking about, 3D printing. But in relation to Iron Man, for instance.
So in Iron Man, in all the movies, they portray him as kind of a maker, even though that word is never used, somebody who can tinker at home and make prototypes and make whatever he wants, in the third movie it being multiple suits. And this is getting very close to the ideas that are coming up now, where 3D printing, additive manufacturing is becoming much cheaper. You can buy a home kit off of a Kickstarter project for $300 and start making things at home. And while I think this is a great thing, I think there's also some implications, as indicated by the recent 3D printing of a plastic gun, where the only metallic piece was a nail. So there's a lot of societal responsibility that's going to come along with being like Iron Man and tinkering and being able to make what you want.
The nail being the bullet. So it becomes an interesting kind of defense problem, which leads to this bigger question. You work in kind of defense projects, military applications. And, of course, the question is, suppose we took all of this technology and even unilaterally, our side, whoever the enemy might be, and we say, let's apply it only to peaceful uses so that we have plenty of stuff. And if we gave it away, then there'd be no reason to attack us because the world has what it needs, and why would you bother? So the idea of defense is you got something somebody else wants, give it away, share it all, and then use the technology that way, and we don't have to be making shields or guns or nails to be fired from guns anymore.
Well, I'll speak to that from the perspective of what I do in my job. What I support is all basic science, unclassified, open access data that very much could lead to a benefit for the warfighter, but more often than not leads to a beneficial civilian application. For example, the roots of the laser were originally supported by the Army Research Office, and lasers certainly have been useful in defense applications, but they've been useful everywhere else. And so specifically what we do in our mission is to enable basic science in support of the soldier. None of that's classified. It's all open, and as you said, it's distributed in the open literature.
So I understand you had a small to-do over Thor's hammer. This is kind of interesting.
Yeah.
Another mysterious weapon that shows up in Marvel Comics, but it ended up being kind of part of the annals of science as well. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so with all respect to Neil deGrasse Tyson, he went on his Twitter feed and posted that the weight of Thor's hammer was as much as 300 billion elephants, based on him hearing that the hammer was forged from the core of a dying sun, which is likely neutron matter or high-density matter. Well, it was forged in the core, not of the core.
Uh-huh.
So there's a lot of implications that come with something having that kind of density. My rebuttal wasn't quite scientific. Having been a comic book fan, I had a comic book card from my childhood that said it weighed 42.3 pounds on the back. So I did some mathematical calculations and found that the density of the hammer would actually be less than aluminum. and then postulated some materials. Interestingly, this dialogue ended up in the most recent Incredible Hulk issue, where Bruce Banner is talking to another character and doesn't go with my theory or DeGrasse's theory, but goes with another physicist's theory on how it works, but then says maybe it's just magic. In the end, it's the worthiness clause that keeps it from being picked up.
The worthiness clause?
Yeah, Odin put a clause that only those who are worthy would be able to wield the hammer. So ultimately, it's some sort of device that can emit its own gravitons and change its mass.
There you are. It's dynamic. It's not in the material itself, but in the relationship between the user and the material.
Correct.
Fantastic. Great to talk with you.
Thank you.
Savine Muthadu is a professor in the Department of Material Science and Engineering at North Carolina State University, also the program manager of synthesis and processing at the U.S. Army Research Office. Thanks for listening to The State of Things. You know, you can go to our website, stateofthings.org. You can hear archived editions of the program and also see any messages posted about our programs. State of Things is directed by Alex Granados and produced by Sean Wen and Nicole Campbell. Adija Manley and Mark Haywood are the interns. Robin Copley is the technical director. Brent Wolf is WUNC's news director. And this is North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.